You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Hello, hello, hello out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that often lift above the average, but most definitely separate these films from the average viewing. And we're talking horror and science fiction here, folks. We would like to welcome any of you back that have joined us before. You are used to our unique and strange brand of criticism. Actually, I don't know that it's strange. David asked me the other day, what is a critic? And I really don't know.
Good point.
Yeah. And if you're new, well, then you'll know why we go off on these meandering speculations and digressions. I am here with my friend and co-host David Horton. David, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. That was such a quaint little introduction you did with many questions raised. So there you go. We normally start by, well, 2 points. One, I want to stress that as we've said, this is an unrehearsed and unscripted podcast, so we don't like to do a lot of prep together on these. We do them separately, individually, and then we just kind of get together and talk about it. So we don't know what we're going to say to each other, which keeps, to me, the conversation lively and keeps it interesting as opposed to a big scripted thing, which a lot of other podcasters do.
Well, it's actually a conversation.
Correct. And that's just one of the things I like about it. So sometimes you will hear us talking over each other because Tim won't listen to me. No. But
because I'm an ogre. Times.
And then second thing is we always try to start with what have each of us been doing in our genre-related week? In other words, what kind of, in addition to the topic of the week, what have we been doing? And I stumbled upon a little film which I thought I was pleasantly surprised by. It is a film that came out in 2022. It's called The Adam Project. Have you heard about this?
Is it animated?
Nope. It's live action. I kind of stuck on it because of the cast. It's Ryan Reynolds, Zoe Saldana, and Mark Ruffalo.
It's a Marvel movie?
Wow, is it a Marvel? Yeah, I thought the same thing. Is it a Marvel movie? Looked into it. No, it's actually produced by Sean Levy. Do you know that name, Sean Levy?
No, I know Eugene Levy.
No, different family. But Sean Levy is a big producer. He's done a ton of stuff. One little thing that he produces and also directs some of the episodes you might have heard of is called Stranger Things.
Oh, that rings a bell.
Before that, he did an entire kind of Disney franchise called Night at the Museum.
Yeah, heard of that.
So he's done those. He also was one of the key producers of a movie both you and I like called Arrival. So I thought, wow. And this was a science fiction film. Basically, it deals with a fighter pilot who is also a time traveler who goes back from 2050. He goes back to 2022 to meet his 12-year-old self to help him do a mission together. It's very interesting. You know, time travel stories I'm always picky about because, you know, time travel can be a big problem sort of thing. And this does what a lot of modern time travel movies do in that it just kind of says when people start raising objections like, oh, no, you're going to destroy the timelines. Oh, you're creating a singularity. They just go, time travel doesn't work that way. Don't worry about it. Keep going. And they just ignore it and do what they do. The only thing they actually stick to normal time travel guidelines is if your younger self is killed, you would die too, of course, because you don't exist anymore. You don't exist in this timeline sort of thing. But This one's great because they make fun of Disney and Marvel in places. They do, you know, somebody mentions, so this is a multiverse. He goes, oh, shut up, multiverse. I hate that freaking word. You know, you go, okay, great. It's Ryan Reynolds' humor all the way through it. It's, I would call it a family science fiction film. Kind of like we did this year. We did Explorers this year, and Explorers was kind of like a family film, but it was more Joe Dante kids oriented. This is more mature, but still has stuff for the whole family because it's got a 12-year-old boy, and then Ryan Reynolds is his adult self. And the way they talk to each other and are written with each other, that same kind of, you know, snark and wit that Ryan Reynolds always does is hilarious. So there's some funny stuff to it. There's some cool science to it. It's a neat time travel story. I really liked it, and I was surprised because I went into it going, oh, this is either going to suck or it's going to be bad.
But, well, I was going to say, I've never heard of it. What's it on? Where did it come from?
It's on Netflix. It's a Netflix original.
Oh, so I'm assuming they Well, that makes sense then.
They had a, you know, a contract to do it, probably because of Stranger Things, I would think.
Yeah.
You know, that Levy probably pushed that. It's got great effects. It's very well done. It's a cool kind of integrated, the way the plot twists and turns with the science and with the time travel aspects are really cool. It's got two action pieces that are kind of action-y, and you're kind of going, eh, I didn't really need that car chase right there, but hey, it's okay. I'll give it to you. So it's great. Jennifer Garner is in it too.
Okay. She's,
she plays their mom, which is kind of interesting, you know, to meet your mom at a bar, kind of thing. And not turn it into Back to the Future. They even have Back to the, they reference, like, we would have a ball with it just for the references and the keys that are in it.
Well, whenever we do a time travel film, it's always that way. We're constantly you know, talking about somewhere in time or the time machine or what have you.
Yeah, Back to the Future or Looper or one of
Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, it's called The Adam Project. You can catch it on Netflix. It's a good, it's a good film, and I think people would like it.
Well, that's very cool.
What about you? You've been genre nating?
I have. I decided to go check out a movie that we, it's been on my radar, and I have mentioned it a few times, so you may, it may sound familiar to you, and it's called The Night House. The reason it is on our radar is because, and it's weird, you know, we're both in our own little genre worlds, and there's all kinds of crossover, especially in the indie world, I'm starting to notice. This one was directed by David Bruckner, who also did The Ritual, which is a movie we considered covering but didn't on our first season. That's a Netflix movie.
Yep.
And then he did the Hellraiser reboot for Hulu last year. It's written by Ben Collins and Luke Pietrowski, and I was like, those names sound familiar to me. Well, not only did they write the Hellraiser reboot, they also wrote that movie Super Dark Times that I talked about in a genre topic several movies back earlier this season. Not necessarily a horror movie, but a really dark movie for sure. Super dark. This movie is dark too. That's why it's called The Night House. It is about a woman that is deeply depressed and trying to find answers for the reason her husband committed suicide.
Okay.
He basically blew his brains out. She didn't see any of this coming. She goes to this lake house they have where I guess they both lived, but maybe he lived there more than her. I don't know. And she starts uncovering things about him that she knew nothing about. And it goes really dark as well. It's got a supernatural twist to it. It is not just a straightforward thriller. I don't want to give anything away, but she finds out, of course, that she was married to someone she really didn't know at all. And it stars Rebecca Hall. Recognize that name?
I don't know from what.
But she looked extremely familiar, and she's fantastic. Brunette? And I was like, who is this? She was in The Prestige.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I thought of her. I thought she was the woman from that HBO. I can't remember that Western. Isn't her name Molly or something? Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's not her. She was from The Prestige. It also stars Sarah Goldberg, who I'm not familiar with, and Vondi Curtis Hall. And I was like, oh, I know him. As soon as I saw him, I was like, that's the reporter from Daredevil. You would recognize a very familiar face with him. This movie, I enjoyed it. It's a little, I had some questions, but it not that nagged me enough that I didn't enjoy it. It scores 88% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is probably about right. I would give it at least an 85. And it is streaming on Amazon Prime for any of you guys out there that want to see it. I had been waiting to watch it, and it dropped on Prime here recently. So, yeah. So, The Night House is what I did in my genre week.
That sounds scary.
It does. Like, and neither one of these really fit with our topic today. I just realized.
Well, mine has a lot of tech in it. So there's a lot of technology that, you know, of course, in any time travel thing, unless it's somewhere in time, there's usually a lot of technology involved in the time travel process and coming back from the future, you know, what's happening in the future.
Well, you could also say it's a blockbuster, and we are on our last two episodes of the season, which usually
we are. Yeah. This is our penultimate episode of this season, and it's been a crazy season. I'm sure we'll do a recap at the end of this, too, for everything. Probably as a bonus episode or something like that. But because, you know, there's been so many, as you've mentioned several times, there's been so many tie-ins we didn't even realize. You know, more foreign movies than we've done in the past, more movies that are linked to each other in certain ways that we didn't even think of when we put the list together. So that was kind of
a lot that neither one of us had seen, too.
Yes, a lot that neither of us had seen. And that made it kind of interesting because we didn't know how each of us would react to the topic of the week. But this week, we are going back to 2008, and we are covering a huge film, a film that literally started an entire legacy that changed Hollywood, that changed movies, that changed people's careers, studios' careers and histories, everything. And we're not talking Star Wars. We are talking a film by Jon Favreau called Iron Man. If you have not seen this movie, we say go watch it right now. A, where have you been?
Right.
And what kind of – yeah, I don't think you're still living on this planet if you haven't seen Iron Man. Go if you haven't, go watch it right now and then come back and listen to the rest of it because we will spoil the crap out of it like we always do. Mm-hmm.
Spoilers
this movie
abound.
Was – just a brief production thing. It's originally based on the comic book created by Stan Lee, of course, directed by Jon Favreau. It's written by Mark Fergus, Hawk Ostby, and Art Markham. There are also some other people that helped with it. And in watching any makings of about this movie, you realize that the cast had a great deal of input into the writing of this movie as well, which is strange to hear on a movie as huge as Marvel has become. But this was the first. So this was the tentpole, the starting of it and everything else. Stars Robert Downey Jr., Gwyneth Paltrow, Terrence Howard, a bunch of other people, Jeff Daniels, Leslie Bibb,
Jeff
Gray,
Bridges,
who I love.
Bridges, not Daniels.
Jeff Bridges. Sorry, not Jeff. Yeah, Bridges, not Daniels. He's the other one. But in case you're unfamiliar, just a brief synopsis. We follow the efforts of Tony Stark, who inherited a huge weapons empire, technology empire from his father. He's a billionaire, playboy, philanthropist, you know, and he is wounded and captured in Afghanistan while he's showing off his latest military weaponry. And realizes that the only way to escape is to be the genius that he is. He designs a metal protective suit to kind of get him out of the prison that he's in and has a change of heart. And it changes his outlook on life. And he develops a protective metal suit that essentially turns him into a
weapon.
Superhero. and he becomes a superhero by the end of it. This was a huge, huge film. Did you see this movie when it came out?
I don't think I saw it in a theater. I cannot remember. I'm pretty sure I rented it.
Mm-hmm.
Because okay. when I've always been a big Marvel fan, but I was never a big Iron Man fan, other than the Avengers, which I read religiously, and he was a member of the Avengers, one of the founding members of the Avengers. I was never a huge Iron Man fan. So I was like, you know what? I like Robert Downey Jr. I think that's great casting, but I'll just wait until it comes out on DVD. And I did. So
I think I saw it at the theater. I saw it just because of the cast around it and, you know, and Favreau, who I had liked. He had done, the sequel to Jumanji.
I knew him from Friends. He was one of Monica's love interests on Friends. That's basically what I remembered him from at the time. I mean, he's a huge name now. Back then, he was not so huge.
Well, and I was also into that. I was from the other side, too, kind of going, ooh, Robert Downey Jr., let's see. I don't know if he can pull this off because, you know, I knew him from his, I'm walking into somebody else's house and falling asleep days and his abuse days when he was, you know, having a lot of struggles and everything else. And I think this was before Chaplin. I'm pretty sure this was before Chaplin.
I can't remember.
So I was curious to go see it, and I had never read the comic books. As people who know who follow us, I was never a comic book fan.
Chaplin was 1992.
Oh, okay.
That was a long time ago. So maybe Chaplin was before his downfall.
Yeah. Maybe. I don't remember. I just remember going into this movie thinking, I don't know if Downey can, you know, handle a lead role. Kind of thing. And of course, he blew me away in the first 5 minutes, which I'm sure we'll get into when we start talking through it. But in watching documentaries about this, by the way, there are some excellent documentaries and extras for this movie.
Oh, really? I didn't
you
see
can
it.
Even, you can even go to YouTube and just look up the making of Iron Man, and there's an almost 3-hour documentary. That is amazing. It covers everything, and it's very unique to see the process of this movie compared to what we know is the process of Marvel now and Kevin Feige's influence and everything. Feige was still involved in this, but it was a lot more, I trust John, let John do what he wants to do. And even Jeff Bridges and Downey Jr. talk about so many of their scenes were improv. They went into it with just an idea, and he said it was treated like this was like this little independent art movie kind of feel to it, even though it was hugely complex in effects and, you know, all the stuff that they did and everything, even down to, you know, the ending line of this movie is
I am Iron Man. Yeah,
that was ad-libbed. That was never in the script. That was totally Robert Downey Jr. on site, and Kevin Feige saw it and said, oh, my God, you got to end it there. That's it. Do it. Sort of thing.
No one's allowed to talk. Is that it? You can't talk?
No, you intimidate them.
Good God, you're a woman.
Is it better to be feared or respected? And I say, is it too much to ask for both? I humbly present the Jericho. To peace.
Tony Stark. Now you work for me.
What are you building, Stark?
Your eyes are red. Your tears for your long-lost boss?
Tears of joy. I hate job hunting.
Yeah, vacation's over.
Welcome home, sir.
Put up the scanner, will you?
What happened over there?
I had my eyes open.
I want to protect the people. I put in harm's way.
A man with a dozen of these can rule all of Asia.
Yeah, I can fly.
Let's see if this dog can hunt.
Ah!
the upgrade is complete.
Tell you what, throw a little hot rod red in there.
What's going on here?
Let's face it, this is not the worst thing you've caught me doing.
There's been speculation that I'm parading around as a superhero. I'm just not the hero type, clearly.
Huge cred going into this movie, too, just from a production standpoint. Mark Fergus, one of the writers, wrote Children of Men. He also is one of the key writers on The Expanse, one of my favorite science fiction series ever.
I saw
Hawk
that.
Hawk Aspie, the same thing. Co-wrote Children of Men, worked on The Expanse. He also did another Jon Favreau called Cowboys and Aliens, which, pretty good, kind of interesting.
I've got a question. Stop.
Yeah.
I think they're the same person.
Hawk Aspie?
Yeah. I don't know why, but if you look up Mark Fergus,
yeah,
you see a picture. This is on IMDb, folks. You see a picture and you see his credits. When you look up Hawk Aspie, it's the exact same picture and the exact same credits.
Really?
So I'm wondering if he had a pseudonym at one time and then just decided, oh, you know what? I'm both of them.
Well, I know that there is one shot in the making of video where Favreau is talking about the writers, and it shows two guys at a desk, and he mentions both of them at a table. They're talking. And
well, there's Favreau another guy named Art Markham that did the screenplay. Yes. So maybe that was who it was. I don't know. I was just curious because I was like, are these guys the same person? I have the same person question mark in my notes.
So I don't know that. That might be interesting. If you guys are out there listening or watching us and you know the truth, let us know in the comments.
But they are. They're both Children of Man, The Expanse, and those projects. So.
Yeah. Art Markham went on. He kind of left. He went. He did Uncharted and a couple of other things. Okay. I guess the best way to talk about this is because, I mean, it's huge legacy. This is a huge legacy film. It set up so much of Marvel in so many ways.
Oh, yeah.
The filmatic Marvel, the Marvel Cinematic. This was before we had the term Marvel Cinematic Universe. As a matter of fact, in the interview, it's so great in this one documentary. It's obviously an interview with Favreau, and it's obviously before the movie opens. But you can tell he's lost weight. He's tired. You can see it in his face, the way they all are at that last like 2 weeks before, you know, a movie is released and they're still editing and there's still sound to do and we're still waiting for 3 or 10 effect shots, yada, yada. And he's going, I honestly don't know. I don't know. This could bomb. This could be a single. Like, oh, it was good. You know, they got one run in to first base, but not really that good. Or it could be a hit. I really can't tell you right now. And I have no clue until we actually, because Marvel is so secretive and we can't even preview this. We're going to hit the ground running with everything, and hopefully it works. And I just went, yeah, it did. I mean, and for those of you who don't know the history and everything else, this was before the mouse bought Marvel. Marvel was a totally separate little, almost independent studio inside, you know, in Hollywood. So this was way before Marvel.
It was not too far, Disney, though. Just a few years.
Yeah, a few years before Disney bought it. But, you know, even back then, Kevin Feige had this idea, which I think we've talked about when we covered Avengers and a couple of the other Marvels, was, you know, we are going to do these independent films, and then we're going to link everything together with the Avengers. And then we're going to go out and do some other independents and link them again with another. Avengers are going to be our focal points of this kind of building cinematic universe that he wanted. And because Hulk came out in the same year. I think Hulk came out in 2008, too.
Is that the one with Norton?
Yes. Yeah.
I never have seen any of the Hulk movies.
It's not bad. It's okay.
Okay.
It's okay. There are some, I guess, I don't know how to proceed with this structurally. What do we want to do? Do we want to talk about scenes?
There's one other groundbreaking thing about this film. Well, not groundbreaking, but it's a definitely sad and climatic at the same time. Is that this was Stan Winston's last film.
Yeah.
And he is an FX god.
Yes.
That did movies like Jurassic Park, Aliens. Didn't he Terminator. Do the Aliens? Yeah, I think he did. Yep. So, I mean, Winston, and the effects in this movie are incredible. A lot of CGI, but it looks real.
Yeah, I was going to say that in my notes. The effects in this movie from 2008 still hold up.
Yeah.
They still hold up. And when you watch some of these documentaries behind the scenes, you see why. I mean, they spent months and months and months on these effects, just tweaking little things, little tiny things that he would say, this needs to look this way, blah, blah, blah. And they would go back and redo it. They have three different effects houses, two in the United States, one in Canada, one of those being, of course, ILM. But they each had their sequences they did, whether it was the flying sequences or whether it was the tech, the actual what they call workshop tech, which is like when Tony's putting on the Mach 2 suits and getting everything and it's doing all the all that is CGI. But it looks real. It still holds up today. I mean, it looks freaking real. I want one of those suits really bad.
I want just that boot that he's working on the table. The boot.
Oh, yeah.
It looks like a big, I don't know, bionic boot.
Yeah. You know, and just other approaches, you know, Favreau telling, you know, Favreau was the perfect man to direct this because he had always liked Iron Man, he said, but always thought what made Iron Man work was not Iron Man, it was Tony Stark. And how do you take a villain, a guy who, you know, makes weapons and kills people, and that's what he does, and that's how he makes all of his money, and he's a philanthropist. I mean, he's not a philanthropist at all. He's a playboy, a billionaire, an alcoholic, all this kind of stuff. How do you make him, by the end of the movie, a hero?
They say the best weapon is one you never have to fire. I respectfully disagree. I prefer the weapon you only have to fire once. That's how Dad did it. That's how America does it. And it's worked out pretty well so far.
And he said that was what made this movie work. And if we had not gotten Robert, we wouldn't have been able to do it, he said at one point, because Robert was so important in the casting.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine anyone else doing it now. However, there were choices. And I'll get to those when we get to casting.
But he even said stuff like when he's talking to the effects group about the flying sequences, he goes, I don't want this to look like Superman. I want us to feel like we're in a helicopter flying around this guy, just catching him flying. So it's that thinking we have to do, that we are flying alongside him, with him, kind of trying to catch him with our cameras, rather than it being so scripted and tight and planned and everything. And I thought, that's really cool.
Well, and he's like a missile more than a man.
Yeah.
Because he can go super fast. Whereas in when we covered Superman earlier this year, there's lots of lighthearted flying and floating kind of stuff. This guy is like a weapon, literally.
Well, and he also said grounding, you know, when he was talking to both ILM and the two other effects companies, he said when it comes to the flying, he said in an interview, he said, I had seen a lot of wire work. And a lot of wire work done. And most audiences have seen wire work. And we know when, you know, you're doing the Matrix and those aren't really practical kicks. They're obviously on wires doing spins. He said, I didn't want that. We needed the wires to not look like they were attached to his waist or his shoulders or his back. We don't want to know. And that's all because of where the center of gravity is. He said, so my guys designed this rig that we could use, which actually put his center of gravity and his lift in his feet. And they show the rig, and the rig has all these plates on his feet, and that's where most of the harnesses are coming, you know, the lifting wires and all of that. So Downey Jr. is having to stand up and hold his weight, and that's what makes it work. And he said, because that looks like what the repulsors are doing, and it gives Robert realism when he's trying to do it, but also gives our effects guys the look that, you know, he has to push with his feet to get back, and he has to come back up the other way.
Mm-hmm.
It was really cool. I mean,
what's going on here?
Let's face it, this is not the worst thing you've caught me doing.
And Downey Jr. spent months in training for this. I didn't know until this that the suit, the Mach 1 suit that you've got a picture of there, the cave suit is what I used to call
it. The Afghanistan Iron Man.
Yeah. That weighed 130 pounds.
Wow.
That's how heavy that suit was.
I bet.
Even the stunt guys could only spend a couple of hours in the suit because it was so heavy and so cumbersome. But it was so realistic. I mean, it worked really well.
Right.
You know. I'm just droning on and on.
Oh, no, you're fine. So cool. You were talking about where to start. And, I mean, we normally start with scenes.
Yeah.
After you synopsize and we talk about the background a bit, did you have any scenes that stand out to you?
Let me glance real quick. What about you?
Well, one of my absolute favorite scenes, this is the third time I've seen this movie, maybe the fourth. I think it's the third.
Okay.
And one of my absolute favorite scenes upon a third viewing is the scene. It doesn't have Robert Downey Jr. in it at all. It's the scene with Pepper Potts getting the files from the ghost drive in front of Obadiah.
Ooh, you would like that one. That's so suspenseful.
It is extremely suspenseful. She is amazing in it. And he's amazing in it because you don't know if he knows what she's doing or not. He's very good at playing both. I do know what you're doing, and I'm really just here chatting. I love that scene. Thought it was great.
What does he say? I know what you're up to, Pepper.
Right.
It's like this line. You're going, what does he mean?
Yes.
What does he mean?
Exactly. Exactly. And then, of course, he does know what she's doing because he sits down and removes the screensaver, and it said file downloaded. And that's when she's got to get out. And it doesn't even end there. It's great when she gets to the bottom of the escalator or elevator or whatever. And Clark Gregg's there still trying to get, you know, to talk to Robert Downey Jr. or to talk to Tony Stark. And she's like, yes, we're ready for that. You need to escort me out right now.
Yeah,
she
right
just
now.
Kind of hooks her arm around him and keeps going.
I guess. Okay.
Coulson
so scene,
is his name. Not Clark Gregg. That's the actor. Agent Coulson. Yeah.
The first scene is brilliant. The first time we see Tony Stark, we see a glass first, and then we pan over to his face. We see a glass of alcohol in the Humvee. And they're playing black. I mean, they're playing Iron Man. Right?
No, it's Back in Black.
Back in Black.
Yep. AC/DC.
And all of that dialogue. So fast, so witty, so funny. You know, he goes, you got excellent bone structure. As a matter of fact, I can't stop looking at you now.
Yeah. She says, do you rehearse that every night in front of the mirror? He said, yes, and I would like to give you a chance to see that in the bedroom or whatever.
Well, now that's the reporter later on.
Oh, I thought was – okay, never mind. I thought that's what you were talking about.
But,
sorry.
No, I'm talking about the scene in the Humvee when they're all talking. He's talking to each other, going to take a picture and all that. Love that whole opening. Another one of mine is a Pepper one. Like you said, I think Gwyneth Paltrow is amazing in this movie.
I do too.
I think she is so good. They said in – so the two scenes I really like, I love the benefit scene. She's got the backless gown. They do the dance. Then they go up to the roof, and it's almost a kiss. You know, that whole sequence, I think, is really good for her.
What, you got plans?
As a matter of fact, they do.
I don't like it when you have plans.
I'm allowed to have plans on my birthday.
It's your birthday?
Yes.
I knew that. Already?
Yeah. Isn't that strange? It's the same day as last year.
Well, get yourself something nice for me.
I already did.
And?
Oh, it was very nice.
Yeah.
Very tasteful. Thank you, Mr. Stark.
You're welcome, Miss Potts.
I also really like the changing of the arc reactor scene when she's going, oh, there's pus. And he goes, it's not pus.
It smells.
He goes, yes, I know. Just don't let it touch the you know.
I love that they joke that it's like Operation. And I wonder if that was a Downey ad lib or a Downey
sure
ad. Because it is like the game Operation when she's reaching inside him. Yeah.
When you watch these making ofs, they show so many behind the scenes and you can see where these lines are crafted and where they come from and where things happen. I love the, you know, and a lot of it is Downey Jr. The whole thing about, you do that to me again? I'm going to donate you to a city college. Talking to the fire extinguisher.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
But so Obadiah, Jeff Bridges' character, is great in this too. He is so good at, like you said, in playing that scene with her, but also just his gloat. The two times he gloats, like when he's with the Afghani guy and first uses the ear thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a great scene. He goes, that's the least of your worries and blah, 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 and walks out. And then later on when he does the same, when he takes the arc reactor from Tony, that scene is so good.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going, you know, remember this, don't you? So bad the military didn't want it because it's so effective. It has so many uses.
Tony, we're a weapons manufacturer.
You know, and you're just going, oh, my God.
Yeah, and he's paralyzed. And so, I mean, Downey is just as good in that scene at playing paralyzed.
Oh, yes.
Because a lot of it's his eye movement. And I did notice toward the end he was starting to move a little bit. I was like, is it wearing off? What's going on?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another scene. I was going to say the escape scene from Afghanistan. The first time you see him use that suit. And it's primitive and clunky. And when he finally blasts off at the end, it only lasts for just like a second. And then he just gets plunging into the desert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it's just him laying there laughing and everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is a good scene.
That's a great scene. And you also have the pathos of him losing his partner. I forgot the guy's name from the city that starts with a G.
You talk about Jensen?
Jensen, yes.
Yeah.
Ends up helping him develop the first suit. And then they don't have enough time for the suit to upload or whatever it is to charge up. And he has to buy time. And Tony's telling him, no, that's not the plan. And then he still goes running out there with the machine gun. And they have the whole Indiana Jones moment where he comes around the corner and all of a sudden there's about 50 people there with guns.
Yep. Very Star Wars, very Indiana Jones.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I got out of that one. This movie has a very Billy Wilder sort of script.
I totally agree. I was thinking that when you mentioned the scene of her and him on the building veranda or whatever you call that.
Yeah.
And the low-cut dress and the almost kiss, all of that reminded me of like a Cary Grant movie or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very Billy Wilder, and it's the dialogue all the way through. It's Downey's delivery, but it's his dialogue.
And the humor.
Wit and the way he plays off of each other. Even you know, he and Rhodey when they're on the plane and he keeps trying to get Rhodey to drink and Terrence Howard, he's like, no, man, I am not going to drink with you. We're at work now. Mm-hmm. He's going, really, Sherry? You don't want one? You just don't want even one? Just share one with me. Come on.
You know, and you cut to him being shit-faced. And that's Favreau, though.
No, we are not drinking sake.
Right.
Yeah.
Favreau brought a lot of that humor into the film with those cuts. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously – Robert Downey Jr. brought the majority of the humor to the film, but I think Favreau brought a good dose of it as well.
Yeah.
And that's very Wilder too.
Yeah. It's all this Billy Wilder dialogue between them. You know, when she goes, you must be the famous Pepper Potts. He still has you doing his laundry? And she goes, yes, I do whatever Mr. Stark asks, even occasionally taking out the trash. You know, it's just so good.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, there's one line that this is probably my like 10th time watching this movie, not third or fourth like you, but there's one line I had never gotten before when he finally gets to the plane and Rhodey is so mad at him, going 3 hours. I've been waiting 3 hours. He goes, he has a line where he goes, yeah, I got stuck doing a piece from Vanity Fair.
Exactly. Yeah. I was like, oh, that's kind of literal.
The double entendre is great. It is perfect. It's really good. That's a good segue to cast. Can we talk about Terrence Howard?
Sure.
What did you think of him?
I love Terrence Howard in this movie. I have somewhere, it may be in trivia, there was a bit of a controversy toward his coming back.
Oh, yeah.
And I can't remember what it was. I think it was that he wanted more money.
Yep.
Okay. I think he's great in this movie. I almost like him better than Don Cheadle, who ended up taking over the part in the subsequent films and the Avengers movies. So I don't know.
I've always thought that. I think Terrence would have added. He's got such a empathetic face. And I've always thought all of his roles, you can see right through his eyes to what he's thinking. He is so expressive. And I thought he would be a really cool, have been a really cool role. As a matter of fact, in one of the documentaries, Favreau talks about the character of Rhodey and how Terrence is perfect for the part and he can't wait. Should this ever be picked up? He goes, you know, we've even talked about, you know, the progression of Rhodey going, turning into War Machine. And I think Terrence will do that justice so well. And it'll be great, blah, 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 blah. And he's talking, just talking up Terrence Howard. And it's like, that won't happen in a year from now.
He's not even in the sequel. They replaced him with Don Cheadle in Iron Man 2, didn't they?
Yeah, he didn't want to come back because he wanted more money. Yeah.
And that's probably because Favreau was talking to him about all the stuff they were going to do.
Maybe. Yeah.
How funny. Funny.
But it's, so I just wanted to segue there because he is one of the few miscasts, and not miscast. I don't think he was miscast. I think his negotiation, he was recast. So kind of like Ed Norton. If you see Ed Norton in that Hulk film, he is actually good in the character. It's not bad at all. Ruffalo is much better, I think.
I'm sure.
But those are two of the ones that I remember predominantly in the Marvel world that were recast.
Yes. Yes, two. I had not considered that, but you're right. The Hulk is a major recast too.
Based on the original.
Back to what you, as far as the overall cast.
Yeah.
I think this movie is one of those rare movies where it is perfectly cast. I think everybody in this movie is exceptional. Even the guy that plays Jensen, is that his name? Yeah, Jensen.
Oh, yes.
He's so great. Good. And I don't even know who he is. I don't have any notes on him. Do you?
Sean Taub.
I mean, I know that's who plays him, but I don't have any notes to like past movies or anything. I guess I could look real quick. But anyway, we would want to probably start. He was in The Kite Runner, Tehran, Snowpiercer, your favorite series.
No, I don't like the movie or the series. he went on to do a lot of television. He's done a lot of television.
All right, but he's great. All right, well, let's start off with the big daddy, and that, of course, is Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark / Iron Man. I am Iron Man. Director Jon Favreau wanted Robert Downey Jr. from the get-go because he felt that the best and worst moments of Robert's life have been played out in the public eye, and they very much are similar to what was going on with Tony Stark as far as being an alcoholic and getting into trouble. Mm-hmm. And he just thought that would translate real well. I think that's great. I think he also really looks like Tony Stark. I mean, when I think of the Tony Stark from the comic books with the mustache and the goatee, I could easily see Downey Jr. in that
role. Yeah.
There's a resemblance as well. Other people considered. Sorry, I thought you were going to say something.
No, I'm curious.
Clive Owen. He's a bit British, isn't he?
Yeah, but he could do American. I mean, you know.
And he had been in Children of Men, which is what two of the writers had worked on before this. Mm-hmm. Sam Rockwell was considered.
Well, he was actually in Iron Man 2.
He ends up playing the rival, Justin Hammer in Iron Man 2. Mm-hmm. Those two were considered. You know who was offered this? And it kind of pisses me off.
Mm-hmm.
Hugh Jackman.
Oh, okay.
I mean, is it like, are you going to, first of all, once you get cast as a major Marvel superhero, I really don't think you should be cast as another one. I think that's a little confusing.
No, I agree with that. I think you're right.
And I just.
Clive Owen would have had to force the humor, I think. Downey Jr.'s wit is just, it's kind of like, You know, when you use any actor like that that's known for their wit, you know, who did I just cover in Adam Project? Ryan Reynolds. You know, they're known for this kind of repartee and everything else, and that's what they're going to do best. So let them do that. I think when you don't do that, or when you miscast them, like to me, Robert Downey Jr. is a terrible Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, okay.
He's terrible as Sherlock Holmes.
He talks because, too fast.
Well, and Sherlock Holmes wasn't that way. He wasn't Whit and Perry all the time. Mm. He was very condescending, actually, in the way he's written. Very similar to the way Cumberbatch plays it. Mm-hmm. But in as Tony Stark, yes, I agree with you. There's a, again, going back to the documentaries, there's a lot on the comic books themselves. And the fact, just like you said, there were huge comic book fans before Iron Man, but and Marvel fans, but most of them didn't like Iron Man. Iron Man wasn't very popular.
No, he was not Spider-Man or the Hulk. No.
Right. And that totally blew me away because, again, being a non-comic book nerd, I didn't know that. And I just assumed, oh, so Iron Man was just as popular and blah, blah, blah. Oh, no, he was not. And that's why it was kind of a push to get this movie made in that respect, because it was Favreau's vision talking to Feige about it and convincing the studio that, yeah, it would be good and we can reinvent essentially Iron Man. We can make people like him. But they show so many of the comic book frames and everything else and all that wit he has and his romancing and his kind of condescension is all there in the comic book. And Downey Jr. just gives it this affable kind of, you kind of like me, don't you? You know, kind of attitude to it, which works.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very well.
As a matter of fact, if you go back to the comics, you know, he's now known as the Golden Avenger or whatever. But if you go back to the comics, he appeared in 1963 in Tales of Suspense and was in that for a while. And he looked very much like the Afghanistan Iron Man you see in this movie. He was not sleek and cool at all. He was just a big clunky monster kind of robot. And really, he didn't. He still had a clunky suit, I want to say, in the first Avengers comics in 68. Because his comic really didn't debut till 68. He appeared in 63 and then was a running character in Tales of Suspense before he got his own comic in 68 around the time, or shortly after, maybe. I think it was around the same time as the Avengers. And then eventually got the gold suit. But what I was going to say earlier about Hugh Jackman is, I mean, I consider Iron Man to be the birth of Marvel, honestly. I mean, I know you had the X-Men movies that were popular, and Hugh Jackman was popular, and you had the Spider-Man movies that Sam Raimi did, and they were good, but I still don't like the way they did Green Goblin in the first Spider-Man movie. Anyway, I see their popularity, but I kind of find – I'm a little resentful that, you know – for a while, whenever you said Marvel, people say Hugh Jackman. It was like he, right. I guess, became so popular as Wolverine. Okay, yeah, we'll make him Iron Man. I'm like, no, 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 you don't do that. Mm-mm. And that's all I'm going to say.
I agree with you.
Other people interested in playing Iron Man? Nicolas Cage.
Yeah. No.
I know. It would be so horrible. However, he did go on to play Ghost Rider, which I have not seen. And that is another Marvel superhero. Well,
don't worry about it. It's not. Instead, watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Season 3 when Ghost Rider is in it, because that Ghost Rider is really good.
Oh, and it's not him. It's really good. Okay.
And it's not him.
Oh, cool.
But watch that. It's really good.
And then the other person that wanted to play Iron Man, who – I would just have never seen this movie. Guess.
Tom Cruise.
Yes. Exactly. Golly. Tom Cruise was interested in playing it, and he wanted to produce it as well.
Well, sorry. No.
Yeah, I agree. Nope.
That was a smart decision.
Mm-hmm. Another person that read for the role who I really admired – I mean, I admire still. And if he bulked up, could potentially do it because he's got the snarky wit, is Timothy Oliphant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I could have probably seen that. But I don't think you can get better than Robert Downey Jr. You just can't.
Nope. Not at all.
Nope.
No, he is brilliant, and I think to so many people he is the heart of Marvel. You know, that's why they ended Endgame the way they did.
Mm-hmm.
Tony Stark's conversion from warmonger playboy to self-sacrificing, you know, father figure is the arc of the first three phases of Marvel, as far as the cinematic, you know, the MCU, I guess, is the way to say it.
Yeah, really, Iron Man is the structure of all three phases.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see what you're
saying.
Yeah,
and it's his redemption arc that is really this spine that goes all the way through it. That's why I think they're floundering now from Eternals on, is they don't have a focal point like that. Even subliminally, they don't have a focal point underneath. Whether it's Wanda or Loki or whomever, they don't have a Tony Stark.
And what's funny is the first thing that comes to my head that they could use to do one would be Fantastic Four, and they've had like three failed movies of that.
Yeah,
I'm like, what?
They can't get that franchise.
Because Reed Richards could be a character very similar, and it's a very family focused.
You have so many parallels. You have, you know, Thing is Hulk,
mm-hmm.
and you know Johnny Torch or Tommy Torch or whatever
the Human
his name
Torch
is Flash, you know, and so you've got all of these
Flashes in DC.
Well, I know, but you've got these comparative superheroes all together in a pack. So you've all got a mini Avengers
mm-hmm.
kind of story that you could then, you know, play off of all four of them. And how they work,
right? But
yeah, that's a cool idea. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, and they're rebooting it yet again. There's another Fantastic Four movie coming, so
I'm sure there will be.
Hopefully, they'll get it right. I didn't see any past the first one, which also starred Chris Evans as the Human Torch before they cast him as Captain America.
Yep.
Anyway. We're going off on Marvel, but I knew that we would. I mean, we've already covered the Avengers, which was the first climax, I guess you would say, of the first phase of films.
Yes.
And obviously Iron Man kicked it off. And then we've also covered Infinity War and Endgame, which was, like you said, the end of this arc with Iron Man.
Yeah.
So it's fitting that we're covering the beginning of it now.
What was it? 10 years, 20 movies in the making mm-hmm. to get to Endgame. And all of them worked.
Mm-hmm.
So even though the Thors are still the lowest on my totem pole, but they're still there kind of thing. Yeah.
Hmm. I don't know. There's so many now. I don't even know how I would rank them.
Yeah, it would be difficult. I think you would have to, you know, pare down your ranking system.
You would have to.
Like,
I mean, there's just too many. We've already talked a little bit about Terrence Howard, who played Rhodey.
Yeah.
He was thrilled to work with Robert Downey Jr. because he was a fan of Weird Science. I thought that was funny, which is probably one of the first things I ever saw him in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can't think of anything else. And that
Terrence
was with
Howard?
Anthony Michael Hall. No, Robert Downey Jr. I was talking about. Terrence Howard, I've seen in other things. He was in that series that was really popular on Fox, was it? The one about the record company? I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I've seen Terrence Howard in other films. I think he's great. Jeff Bridges.
Empire
is this, the series with Terrence Howard. Jeff Bridges, to me, is the other giant in this film. And he blows me away because I've always thought of Jeff Bridges as the affable, long-haired guy from King Kong remake in 1976 with Jessica Lange.
Well, that's because you worked with him. So I mean,
No. I was in the sequel. He was in the original.
Oh, that's right.
I've always just thought of him as a really nice guy. I never pictured him as a villain, and he is great at it.
Yeah.
I never had a taste for this sort of thing, but I must admit, I'm deeply enjoying the suit.
This was a really good, I think, turn for him, because I'm like you. I had always considered him as the likable, if not the hero of the film, he's the hero's best friend kind of thing.
Exactly.
You know, Tron, Tucker. He was the lead in Tucker. Fabulous Baker Boys. I remember that one.
Mm-hmm.
So many that he did that were, you know, he's the lead. He's the hero. He's the good guy. And then to play this villain this nicely, the way he does him, it's a very Lex Luthor-y kind of feel to Obadiah, in my opinion, not knowing comic books at all.
Right.
But, you know, he's a very affable, this is all about business, Tony, and we're going to do this because this is what's good for humans. And he believes it. You know, we've talked before about, you know, when you're doing character interpretation, the villain has to believe that they don't think they're a villain. If you play a villain like he knows he's a bad guy, then it turns out to be that mustache twirling kind of fake thing. And that's not what a villain is. The best villains are the ones that believe what they're doing. They think they're being right. They think they're the hero.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Obadiah does. He thinks he's doing the right thing.
And it's very shocking when you find out that not only is his heart in that direction, but he was going to have Tony killed.
Twice.
Yeah.
Twice. Yeah. Yeah. He's the one that commissioned the whole thing at the very first scene. He's the one that commissioned the hit on Tony.
Yeah. I think it was very wise that he cut his hair or shaved his head and was bald. And I read that he did research on that and wanted, it was his idea to do that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. John Favreau said, no, you do not have to do that. We don't want that. And he goes, oh, yeah, but the character is that way. So I want to. And he said over like the first week of 2 weeks of rehearsal, he just gradually cut his hair shorter and shorter and shorter each rehearsal. They came together in meeting. So that finally he said, can I just go ahead and shave it?
Well, and I think I read that he had researched like bald villains because there's like one in James Bond and.
Well, yeah.
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 And I don't know. I guess there's.
Well, Goldfinger is bald.
Well, no. Yeah. I'm talking about, I don't know if there's like an archetype of bald villains. Is that like something that, you know, you associate with evil baldness sometimes? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. The two that come to mind immediately for me are Lex Luthor, and then the good one is Daddy Warbucks from Annie.
Right.
He was bald, right? Yeah.
But I think
he was a good guy.
Well, and when you mention Bond, I immediately see Mike Myers doing Dr. Evil. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There really is nothing like a shorn scrotum. It's breathtaking. I suggest you try it.
Pepper Potts is played by Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yes, she is.
I think she is underrated in a lot of what she does, especially Marvel movies.
But I agree.
She brings a genuineness to the character that I just think is unsurpassed by other female cohorts. And I would immediately say, what's the Natalie Portman? I think Gwyneth Paltrow is better in Iron Man than Natalie Portman is in Thor. And she's the same kind of side character, I guess you would say.
Well, I would agree.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree.
There's a depth there.
I think she, I don't know if something happened to her off camera, so to speak, like publicity wise or whatever, or why she ended up getting such, or gets a bad rap in Hollywood a lot of times.
It's because of her hippie company, Goop, or whatever. A lot of, and she put that candle out that smells like her vagina.
Well, it's a candle.
Yeah.
And, so it's called This Smells Like My Vagina. So it sort of started as a joke. I was with the nose Douglas Little for his brand Heretic, and we were kind of messing around, and I smelled this beautiful thing and I was like, this smells like my vagina. Right. And I was kidding, obviously.
Okay, then.
That's the name of the candle. This candle smells like my vagina or something like that. I can't remember. Yeah. So she's done some quirky things. But then again, so is Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, because I'd remembered Gwyneth from Seven, of course.
Oh, yeah.
I remember from, you know, Shakespeare in Love.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. She's wonderful.
So she's always been really good. And I thought she was great as Pepper Potts. And I think she has been in all. How many Iron Men? Three?
She's been in all three Iron Men. She's been in probably all the Avengers movies, or at least a few of them.
Yeah, I think she's in all the Avengers, and especially in Endgame. I mean, they have the you know the girls moment in Endgame.
Yeah, because she becomes like a female Iron Man.
Yeah, she wears. He makes a suit for her.
Right, and well, when I think of Gwyneth Paltrow, I think of acting royalty, and I immediately see her mother, Blythe Danner, who I also love. So yes. I just feel like she's got acting in her genetics, you know, in her ancestry.
Yes, agreed.
Another person that was Favreau's first choice to play this role was Rachel McAdams. And I like Rachel McAdams a lot. I mentioned, I think, on the last podcast that she's in a movie called Red Eye with Cillian Murphy, directed by Wes Craven, that I love. It's a thriller on an airplane. But she went on to play the love interest in Doctor Strange, the one that's killed. Isn't she killed? I think she's killed in a car wreck, and he can't save her.
No. Isn't she the... Because he comes in later on. She leaves him. He comes back. I don't think she's killed. He's in the car crash because he's racing doing stuff at the same time and all of that. I like Rachel McAdams.
I do too.
You actually said it. There's a royalty factor feel to Gwyneth that Rachel McAdams doesn't have.
Right.
There's a businesswoman sort of take charge, I know what I want kind of confidence underneath her that can't remember seeing in Rachel in anything, even Strange. I mean, even in The Notebook, you know, she's a nice ingenue in The Notebook, and it works for me. But I don't see her with that.
Mm-mm, I don't either.
I can now lead this company kind of thing.
No, it's funny that you said that about royalty, because Gwyneth is not only of acting ancestry, but she's also one of those actors that marries other famous people, like, you know, Brad Pitt and that guy from Coldplay. So she's kind of a big celebrity persona as well.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I had about her is that, and this is what this ties into our Billy Wilder stuff, is that she based her performance, and this is what a real actress would do, based her performance on 1940s heroines who she claimed were sexy, witty, and innocent all at once.
Again, it's that Billy Wilder 40s kind of feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She put a lot of thought into it, very similarly to Jeff Bridges and Robert Downey Jr. Other people in this film, three that I don't have anything on, but I liked, are Leslie Bibb, who plays the piece from Vanity Fair.
Yep.
Sean Tube, who played Jensen. I think he's fantastic. Farhan Tahir, who played Raza, the other bald Afghanistan villain.
So menacing.
Very menacing.
He is also in Star Trek.
Is he? He is in the reboot?
The JJ reboot, yeah.
What does he play?
He's one of the captains.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Then that brings us down to Clark Gregg, who plays Agent Coulson.
Mr. Stark.
Yeah?
Agent Coulson.
Oh, yeah. The guy from the...
Strategic Homeland Intervention Enforcement and Logistics Division.
God, you need a new name for that.
Yeah, I hear that a lot.
Always. One of my favorites.
I love him. I have liked him for so long. I mean, I knew him from sitcoms before I saw him in movies.
Yes.
He played Christine's ex-husband on The New Adventures of Old Christine. That's where I really got to know him because I liked that show a lot.
Yeah. If you like Clark Gregg, I really highly recommend Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Okay.
He is phenomenal. He is the Tony Stark of that series. He's the anchor of that series, and he is great in his range that he does. At one point during the series, he gets to play a villain, and seeing him play a villain is so unique and different. It's like a Jeff Bridges kind of thing. It's really cool. I highly recommend you watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It's 5 years of fun. I wish they had. I wish. And I've said it before on the podcast, I wish Marvel would accept it as canon because it so ties into so many of the movies. And I wish it was still going, but it's not. So there's that. Whatever. Well,
I think somebody should do a Fred Astaire biopic and cast Coulson as Fred Astaire.
Oh, yeah. He would be awesome.
I think he looks a lot like Fred Astaire.
He would have fun with that. Yep.
Apparently, when he was cast in this movie, it was a very small part. And in fact, didn't even have a name. He was just known as Agent.
Right.
But as the filming continued and the chemistry with other members of the cast became apparent, they started adding more scenes with him. Mm-hmm. And he has since gone on to be another important part of the first phase of these Marvel movies.
A huge part in Avengers.
Right. Well, he dies in Avengers. Yep. Isn't that the one he dies in? Yes.
Yep. And the year after, they start Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Exactly. But between that, he did Iron Man 2, Thor, and the Avengers. He is in Captain Marvel because that's back in time. And then he's in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So, I mean, he is in a lot of Marvel stuff.
Yes.
Great character. And I'm assuming he was invented because I don't think he's in the comics at all.
I wouldn't be able to tell you that, but.
I wouldn't either. I didn't look up Coulson in the comics. And then there's a couple of others. The Syed Badara played the secondary baddie in Afghanistan. I don't have anything on him. And then there's General. I guess it's Rhodey's boss. His name was Bill Smitrovich. But the other really almost invisible, I guess you'd say invisible character to this is Jarvis. Oh. And that is played by Paul Bettany.
Paul Bettany.
And, of course, Paul Bettany goes on to evolve into the character of Vision in the latter things, which is very similar to his evolution in the comics, if I remember right. But in the comics, I think Vision was actually the repurposed android of the original Human Torch from the 40s. That is some deep comic nerddom for you people out there.
Wow.
If you ever read like the Invaders series with Submariner, the Human Torch, not the one from Fantastic Four, it's a different one, and Captain America, that Human Torch ended up evolving into the Vision, and he was an android as well. However, Paul Bettany has never seen Iron Man. He is unfamiliar with the plot. He said Jarvis was the easiest job he has ever had and that it was almost like robbery.
Yeah.
I think that's funny. He said he got paid a lot of money to work for 2 hours, then took a vacation with his wife, Jennifer Connelly.
Yeah, basically. There you go.
And what's ironic about that is that Jennifer Connelly apparently went on to be an AI voice in Spider-Man Homecoming. So they are AI spouses.
AI spouses.
That's in the cool. Marvel universe.
Yeah.
And like I said, later that role was expanded tremendously when he became Vision, one of my favorite characters.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah. That's all I have as far as cast awards. There are scads.
I'm sure.
I mean, literally scads of awards for this movie. Mostly are nominations, but they did have a fair share of wins. I put a few in here just to give mention to. It was nominated for Academy Awards in sound editing and visual effects. I'm not sure what beat it. It was nominated for a BAFTA in visual effects. The Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films that do the Saturn Awards gave it a win for Best Science Fiction Film, Best Actor, and Best Director. Well deserved.
Yes.
But it was also nominated for Best Actress, Gwyneth Paltrow, Supporting Actor, Jeff Bridges, Writing, those guys you talked about earlier, Music, and Special Effects.
You know who did the music?
Well, I can tell you. Ramin Djawadi.
Ramin Djawadi, same guy that did Westworld, same guy that did House of the Dragon, same guy that did Game of Thrones.
Okay.
Excellent, excellent composer. He's probably jumping up to my second favorite under John Williams.
Well, I'm surprised that wasn't nominated for those bigger awards then.
Yeah, especially in this one because he's used so many. He said there's a brief little thing with him in one of the documentaries, and he talks about he had to create rock music that they didn't have royalties for. So a lot of these rock sequences aren't the actual song. It's an inspired by the song.
Yeah, there was a time in there where I heard something that sounded a little like Black Sabbath, and I was like, wait a minute.
Right, right. And especially with Tony, you know, doing the car, driving the car, flying the planes, all that kind of stuff. And
yeah, the only two rock songs used in this movie are AC/DC and Black Sabbath.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure. Yep. Those are the only two that I recall.
That's it.
And then lastly, and this is not good, but this movie is not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die. And I think that is a mistake.
I do too. I think that's a huge mistake.
Yeah. And we have talked about this. This has happened several times this season where mm-hmm. we've either had one that we didn't think deserved to be on it, was on it. But in most cases where one should have been on it and wasn't.
Yes.
And this one should have been on it.
Oh, definitely.
So,
such a precedent setting for you know 20 years of filmmaking in Hollywood mm-hmm. for how to do a movie, and definitely how to do a superhero movie. X-Men had mm-hmm. been done before this, like you said, Spider-Man had been done before this, but this really showed how to do a superhero movie. And this model has been replicated all the way up to, you know, Wakanda Forever or Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, whatever, the newest ones.
Right. You know, we talked about the humor of the movie. A lot of the humor from the comics that I recall came from Spider-Man. Spider-Man was a very funny character in the comic books because he was a wisecracker, just like Iron Man. And there are scenes in this movie that literally make me gut bust laughing, like the one where he first tries the thrusters at 10 and it just slaps him upside down against the wall behind him.
He literally does a flip. Yeah.
I mean, Robert Downey Jr. gets the shit kicked out of him by himself mm-hmm. in this movie a lot. I mean, I don't think he would have survived that. I don't think he would have survived falling in the desert either.
Yeah, there are some physics problems in this. In that, I think
all his bones would be broke.
Yeah, you're still a human inside this big iron thing, so you won't be able to take that really.
But anyway, that was awards. Other than that, we can do some trivia and some keys, and I think that's where we're headed.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Some trivia. Let me see what I've got in trivia. I've got a couple things. Like you said, Iron Man wasn't popular. They had an interview with Stan Lee, and they said the characters were created because he challenged himself. He said, "How do I create a bad guy and make people like him by the end of it?" Which is what Favreau used as inspiration for working on the script. So that same kind of thing. Favreau said that, Stan Lee said that the key for Tony Stark is Howard Hughes.
Yes.
Because
I had that in my keys, actually.
And did you know a key coming out of that was they actually filmed a lot of this movie in the warehouses where the Spruce Goose was built. The studio created the sound stages where in these old aircraft hangars where the Spruce Goose was built by Howard Hughes. So I thought that was interesting. Stan Lee has said that Iron Man got more fan mail from females than any other Marvel hero. Even though he was not that popular, there were more females who were writing about Iron Man or writing to Iron Man.
Because he was sexy and he had money.
Yeah, sexy. Yeah. And that's exactly unpolitically correct what Stan Lee says. He goes, because he was really good looking and you had his money too.
Right. I mean, Peter Parker was just a nerdy high school kid, you know.
And
Bruce Banner was not hot unless he was the Hulk. You know,
and Stan Lee has said he was never comfortable with the armor design. That's why he kept changing it. If you look back at the history of the comics, the mm-hmm. armor keeps changing color, keeps changing shape, keeps changing everything. He was never comfortable with it until he saw Addy Granov's designs for the Mach 3, which is the red and gold armor that they used in the actual movie.
I thought, well, I know Jack Kirby did the original art.
Correct.
So maybe he didn't do, okay.
He still didn't do it as well as what, as Stanley is saying, as well as what.
No, Bobby it looks Grano like did. A big monster.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's credited with reimagining the suit in a technical way that actually works for both the comics and for the movie. So. Hmm.
Interesting. I have that Michael Bay has called this his favorite Marvel film.
Well, yeah, it does have a lot of explosions. So
a lot of explosions. Like that. That's exactly what I thought.
Yep.
And then the only other trivia I have, I'm going to read this because it's a little long. When the film was under development, it was never intended to set up a larger cinematic universe. As such, the post-credit scenes featuring Nick Fury recruiting Tony Stark for the Avengers initiative was cut in the primary release. In the post-Avengers releases, since Kevin Feige, is it Feige?
Feige.
Took over production powers after Avi Arad's departure, restored the post-credit scene, and it's now available in all prints. So at one point, that scene was cut.
Yes.
That's a mistake, man. I mean, that was probably the first post-credit scene, wasn't it?
It was. It was the first post-credit scene. That's another, you know, key to this.
Yeah.
And it was a post-credit scene, not a mid-credit scene. That happened later on after Avengers when they started doing mid-credit scenes.
Yeah, it's like they're a joke on themselves.
Right, right. And the tie-in. But Kevin Feige had always wanted this to be a franchise, of course, and to build a cinematic universe. He just didn't know if it would be popular. And, you know, comparatively, I was looking at the costs and the return. You know, it's not the huge hit that, you know, Black Panther was or Avengers or anything. I mean, it cost $140 million. It only earned like $500 million worldwide. So that's not a huge percentage. It was a hit, don't get me wrong, and it was popular, and it obviously spurred the Marvel Universe, but not compared to where Marvel goes from here and what they end up doing. But yeah, I had also read that it was in development for like 6 or 8 years before Marvel got it by both Fox and New Line. New Line Cinema owned it at one point and was developing Iron Man.
Oh, I have some notes early on that I forgot to do.
Yeah.
And they are production notes.
Okay.
A lot of directors were tied to this film before Favreau got it. Did you know that?
I did not know. I mean, at Marvel?
No.
Okay.
In 1999, Quentin Tarantino was approached to write and direct the film.
No.
Later, your buddy, Josh Whedon, who is a big fan of the comic book, was in negotiations to direct it in 2001.
Yeah.
Didn't happen. In 2004, Nick Cassavetes, son of John Cassavetes, who I've talked about on this podcast, was hired as a director with the film to release in 2006. Mm. And that fell through.
Yep.
Finally, Favreau was hired as director in April of 26. And of course, Whedon went on to direct the first two Avengers films. So he's still tied to it. But I can't see anyone else. Out of all of those directors, none of them are Favreau. I don't think they would have been as good.
I don't know. Whedon could have done it. He really could. Because I love both the Avengers movies. Of course, I love Buffy. I've loved everything Whedon's done, irregardless of, he might be a grumpy, mean guy on set. So is everyone's favorite James Cameron. Yet he doesn't become a pariah. Anyway, that's my.
I've got more.
That's my statement. Keep going.
The film had a torturous development process. Those are IMD's words.
Yep.
Stuart Gordon was originally going to direct it in 1990.
Wow.
So it would have looked like that old Spider-Man thing where he spun a web and a net dropped down from the ceiling, I'm sure.
A rope came out.
Yeah, it would have been horrible. Yeah. Uh-huh. But the rights then were held by Universal Pictures. Nothing came of that. 20th Century Fox acquired the rights in 1996, and that's when Nicolas Cage was interested in the project. 2 years later, it hadn't moved on. That's when Tom Cruise became interested in the project. So, I mean, this thing's been going on since 1990. It was in development basically for 20 years.
Yep. That makes sense.
Do I have anything else? Stan Lee wrote a script that very little resembles what it ended up being. And I think I read somewhere where he was a little sad about that. In 1999 is when Tarantino was approached. Then the rights moved to New Line Cinema, home of Freddy Krueger, with Ted Elliott, Terry Rossio, and Tim McClanney's writing a screenplay. This version even featured a cameo by Nick Fury. And New Line Cinema are the ones that were talking to Josh Whedon to do it.
Hmm. Okay.
And then 2004 was when Nick Cassavetes was attached, and all of that failed. And then finally in 2007 and 8 is when Favreau made it happen.
Wow.
So I meant to do that earlier and I completely forgot. And someone else named Len Wiseman was also, looked at to direct. He did the Underworld movies.
Oh, okay.
So
lots of effects oriented. So yeah.
Yeah, lots of crazy development on this. I don't know how somehow we jumped into scenes and I forgot to do that. Sorry, folks.
Totally okay.
Yeah. Keys.
Keys. I have a few. I don't have a lot because I've already mentioned most of them. I think the first key would have to be, you know, the comic book and Stan Lee, of course. That's where it came from. You've talked about it a little bit and where it came from. In that interview with Lee, he also said that in the original, the war is Vietnam. That's where Tony is actually captured.
It's Tales of Suspense, issue number 39 from 1963.
Mm-hmm.
And then he really didn't get his own comic until 68. And I'm pretty sure that was almost simultaneous with Avengers. Avengers may have been a little earlier.
Yeah.
67 maybe. Because I know he had the weird armor still at the beginning of the Avengers comics. But then I think at the premiere of his first issue, it was red and gold.
Okay.
So.
I've got James Bond. I think James Bond is a huge reference point for Tony Stark and that kind of superhero-y kind of arrogance. I mean, he was a secret agent, not a playboy philanthropist inventor. But that the way they handle themselves, the way they deal with all the women, the way they, you know, do that is a very James Bond feel to me.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Mm-hmm.
I have one that you may have picked up on, that just kind of leapt into my face last night while I was watching this, and it is Alien.
Yeah.
And it's the scene where Pepper is going through the chains that are hanging, and all of a sudden, Obadiah, as the Iron Giant's eyes open up.
Yep.
And I was like, this is like the whole... Is it Harry Dean Stanton
that
gets killed that
Harry
way?
Dean Stanton gets killed with the chains.
In Alien, it just was really scary.
Yeah. I've got an Aliens reference, which of course is, you know, Obadiah in the suit at the end when he opens it up and it's just basically him fighting Tony and he's inside it. It's very Mech Warrior, like Aliens, like Avatar. It's that kind of feel to it.
But I must admit... I'm deeply enjoying the suit.
I also caught I caught a couple of lines that I had not seen before in my many iterations of watching this movie. But one of them that really hit me is actually mentioned three different times, and that is the group that kidnaps Tony is hired by Obadiah to actually kill Tony. They end up kidnapping him because they realize who he is, then threaten Obadiah with it, and then blah, blah, blah. You know, anyway, that group calls themselves the Ten Rings. And I did not even get that the first dozen times
Shang-Chi.
I've seen this. So Shang-Chi and also the Mandarin. The Mandarin is part of the Ten Rings.
Yeah, they at one point, I think we're going to have the Mandarin be a villain in this or something.
But they actually had a script version that had the Mandarin in this.
Yes. That may have been the Stan Lee script now that I think about it.
Maybe, but, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have a huge. You've mentioned DC a few times. Ryan Reynolds also played Green Lantern in the DC universe.
Yeah.
But my key is Batman. I think Iron Man is the Marvel version of Batman.
Of course.
I mean, yeah. Pretty much.
Totally agree.
I mean, it's not an Avenger. I mean, it's not a vengeance thing with his parents being murdered so much as it is he's a rich playboy genius that can invent lots of really cool things that can turn him into a superhero, which is Batman.
Yeah. And so. For a while, he's got it as an alter ego sort of thing. But then he ends it by saying, I am Iron Man, and just admits it, just says, I am, you know, because that ego. And again, I do think, and we see it played out through the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Tony Stark does have some daddy issues, you know, that he has to resolve. So yeah, parents are an influence on a lot of these superheroes in one way or the other. You know,
yeah, how and many, there's a different.
Somebody said that recently. I was watching it. It was on TikTok or something, but somebody was talking about all of the superheroes who have missing or dead parents. And I went, oh my God, it's like all of them.
Yeah. It's a lot.
Yeah.
And I did, you mentioned his father. I didn't have this in my trivia, but I noticed that the picture of his father that is shown in this is not John Slattery, who ends up playing him in the later movies.
Correct.
When they go back in the past. Yeah. And I like John Slattery. I think he's great.
However, there is a cool Easter egg in that the picture that they show during that, because, you know, we start out with the great action sequence and all the wit and parry of Tony Stark and then him being captured. And then suddenly we go to, what is it, 2 weeks earlier or whatever, and we're getting the documentary on the screen, you know, the exposition dump of Tony Stark, a man whose father did da-da-da, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, they show him as a young Tony Stark, and he's beside a robot. The robot he's beside is the fire extinguisher robot. It's the same one. That's the one he invented at IMT.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great segue to my next key, which is Pixar. That robot is very Pixar-esque.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, that's a great one. Yeah.
Especially after us watching WALL-E last week or the week before. I can't remember. It was a recent podcast.
And the sound editing for that. Like when he gets sad, he goes, you know, and his yes, little arm drops.
Exactly. Yeah. It's almost – and it's shaped almost like the Pixar lamp because yep, the arm comes out at a big angle.
Yeah. It's very much so. That's like the Luxor lamp. That's pretty
cool. And I love how he ends up saving Tony's life.
Yeah. And that's
– because he holds down the little heart to him.
Yeah.
He couldn't reach arc off reactor. The desk.
Yeah.
Yeah, the little arc reactor that Gwyneth saved.
I love it because I've got that in my notes. Great what do I say now? Great, amazing plant that pays off later. Proof that Tony Stark has a heart prototype. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the gift she gives him. And then it turns out to be that's what saved his life.
I always thought, and it's a red herring too, because I thought Jeff Bridges was going to steal that and use the technology.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it ends up they don't do that. So it could have gone either way, really.
Yeah.
And it ends up being what saves him. You mentioned, I said Indiana Jones earlier when Jensen runs around the corner and there's all those people, but you're right. It is Star Wars it's that Han I'm thinking Solo. Of.
Yeah.
It's both of them are Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
So both I've got Star Wars now.
So it works for me.
We mentioned Billy Wilder, James Bond. I put the YouTube documentary in that I'll put a link of that for folks that want to see that. I also have the Howard Hughes thing. But one of the biggest keys that I can think of is Black Sabbath. Black Sabbath wrote a song called Iron Man in the late 60s.
Yep.
Actually, it may have been in the early 70s. I can't remember when Paranoid came out. It's on that album. Tony Stark, of course, says, I am Iron Man in the final scene. That's how that song starts off, with Ozzy's voice distorted saying, I am Iron Man.
Yep.
It is the theme song of the animated series. I didn't realize that. Oh, no, wait. Is it? This is an homage to the popular song by Black Sabbath and the theme song of the animated series. So apparently they say I am Iron Man in that as well. basically, they, I noticed that when they used the song in the closing credits, they lifted Ozzy's vocals out of it. It's just the music.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any of his vocals. I guess because the vocals really don't relate to the movie.
Probably.
Would be my guess. But it works. And it's cool to hear a song by Black Sabbath from like 1972 or whatever in a very popular Marvel movie in 2008.
Second use of Black Sabbath this season. We reviewed Black Sabbath.
Right. Yeah, Black Sabbath has been a key twice this season. Yeah. That's funny.
And I think we could do even a separate short video on just on the legacy of this movie and what it did to the MCU and the keys that actually came from it. From whether it's Jarvis, post-credits, the fact that the story is so history laden. You're dealing with Tony right now, but we're talking about his father and his father's early research and what happened in the past and all of that. And that's, you know, we're just thrown into this universe of geniuses and things that happen, and that way they expand on them later. I mean, because isn't the next major Marvel movie Captain America?
It's close, and they go back in time when his father is alive.
Invented the serum, you know,
and maybe even the shield technology. I can't remember.
But yeah, because that's where he uses vibranium.
He also plays into the whole Tesseract thing too, doesn't he? Somehow,
correct. That's where he gets the power from.
Okay.
Yeah. Because that's what Red Skull wants. It's the Tesseract.
Yeah.
Red Skull has the Tesseract, not Howard.
Right. And I don't think, I mean, when they wrote this movie and Favreau was doing this Iron Man movie, I don't think any of that was planned. I think a lot of that was written in to the future movies. And I think that makes it feel even more cohesive, the way they could weave that the storyline of those Easter eggs or whatever in.
Yeah, I think some of it was, I think some of it wasn't. I mean, you know, they even have that Terrence Howard scene where he looks over and sees the silver suit and goes, next time. And walks away. You know, there's those little throws that are in there. I mean, they have mm-hmm. them in the script, or at least in the ad-libs or whatever. And yeah, so maybe we can't really say because we weren't in the room, but maybe they mined it later and said, oh, then let's have Rhodey as War Machine. But then mm-hmm. again, they've got this comic book legacy that they've been pulling from too. You know, when you watch documentaries on Marvel Cinematic Universe, they go, well, you know, the blueprint was really in the comic book from 1964 when this issue came out, yada yada. And I was mm-hmm. going, really? That's where Thanos came from? Yeah.
Yeah.
You
oh
know,
yeah.
That sort of stuff.
Well, so, and the whole Kang dynasty thing that's going on right now in the multiverse is from the comics as well. Kang. Kang is. I thought of Kang before I thought of Thanos. I thought when they teased Thanos at the end of one of the Avengers movie, I actually thought, "Oh, that's Kang," and it's not.
Yeah, but I think the if I can say it in the right way, it's like the flavor of a Marvel movie is set up in this movie. The use of humor, the use of high action, incredible special effects that actually look realistic, that don't look, you know, too much CGI or too crazy. And this great storytelling of heroes and villains and multi-layers to them. They're not cartoon or comic book characters. They're realistic characters. Even down to the roadies and the villains, you know, the Afghanis and everything. Mm-hmm. So that kind of, it's the blueprint for MCU. It really is. And I wish DC would learn from it, honestly, because other than Wonder Woman, I don't think I've liked any DC movie. So, I mean, maybe a couple of the X-Men I kind of like, but that's Marvel.
That's
right?
Not DC. That's Marvel.
See, I always equate X-Men with, I guess because I've always thought of the X-Men and the Avengers never work together.
They don't really.
So,
and Fantastic Four is kind of its own separate entity too. When I think Marvel, I think more Spider-Man than anything, but Avengers would be a close second just because I was a big fan of that comic.
Yeah, yeah. And see, I'm a big – I've got to say, I'm an Iron Man, Captain America guy before – Spider-Man would be third on my list, you know.
Now?
Well, yeah, after the MCU, definitely.
Yeah, I'm talking about reading the comics.
Oh, yeah, reading – I didn't read, so I don't know.
Right.
Not that I didn't read. Sorry, don't quote me on that. I didn't read comic books.
Well, I didn't read Thor comic books because I hated all the Asgardian speech. They wrote it like ye and thee and thou. And I was like, I can't deal with this. You know, it's like reading the Bible. It's just crazy.
Well, I get thrown off doing research and watching documentaries and everything else. And they'll be talking to this illustrator or this artist or whatever. And they'll be saying, well, you know, because I had read the book when I was a kid and blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, there's a novel about Iron Man? I didn't know there was a comic book. Cause see, to me, in my head, a comic book isn't a book. It's a magazine. It's not a book. A book is, you know, a novel.
Well, they're shorter and they're illustrated, but their arcs can go issues, several issues.
Yeah. So. Well, yeah, but I don't. Yeah.
And sometimes they cross over into other series. Yeah.
It's like I can understand Watchmen because Watchmen in my mind was first given to me as a graphic novel is what they called
it. But Watchmen was originally like a 12-issue series. And it got collected in that graphic novel. Yeah.
But those are 12 books, right? Because an issue is a book. Right?
Comic books.
Yeah, I know the term. I can't get used to it. I can't get used to it. Anyway.
Other things I have lifted from IMDb, keys, that is. Jon Favreau describes this film as an independent film espionage thriller crossbreed. Yeah. And he said, if Robert Altman directed Superman with shades of a Tom Clancy novel, the James Bond films, and RoboCop and Batman Begins.
I can see all of that.
So I guess Robert Altman, the director, who we know for, you know, is very improvisational.
Yes.
Superman, which we've covered this year, any Tom Clancy novel, RoboCop and Batman Begins are all keys because Jon Favreau said they inspired him. So that's why I put that in there.
Makes sense.
There's a mythological key in this. Did you pick up on that?
No.
When Tony flies really, really high, it's like the legend of Icarus flying toward the sun and his wings melting. It's kind of the opposite. Tony freezes and falls. Icarus falls because his wings are made of wax and they melt.
Interesting. I think they're made of wax. I did not get that at all.
Yeah. So that's a very... I think it's Greek mythology. Let me see if I'll get that in there. Daedalus was Icarus's father. His wings were made of wax, and they were melted from the heat of the sun. Yes, that's Greek mythology. So there's no Jarvis warning Icarus to stop, though. I will say that.
Interesting.
Again, back to the Billy Wilder, and I'm not even sure if this is a Billy Wilder film. But Favreau also, like Gwyneth Paltrow, wanted the Stark Pepper Potts relationships to be like a 40s comedy. His example was His Girl Friday, which I mentioned Cary Grant, and I think he's in that.
Yep.
I'm not sure if it's a Billy Wilder movie, though. Are you?
I'm pretty sure it is.
No, it's Howard Hawks.
Howard Hawks. Okay.
Yeah, but very similar.
Yep.
You have more?
Nope. I'm done
with it. I can keep going there.
You keep going.
Tony and Christine's short conversation before she hands him the pictures. Carrie, Christine is a joke to two of Stephen King's most acclaimed novels.
Nice. I did not catch that one.
Not only was Howard Hughes an inspiration for Iron Man, but apparently so was someone still in the news now, Elon Musk. He is kind of a rich dude that's full of himself.
But
that's
not for
sure.
Stan Lee.
No, for
John
for
Favreau?
Iron Man. No, Tony Stark.
Oh, for Iron Man. Yes.
Yeah, I said Howard Hughes is not the only one. Musk would be a more modern one.
Oh, well, one I've got, it is on my notes, is Steve Jobs, because they even said that they thought that a lot of the technology you see is Tony putting his Steve Jobsism on it. Sort of thing.
Okay.
Like they talked about Obadiah's heads up display. I mean, they had an entire graphics company that just did the heads up displays and all of the displays and Tony's holographic you know, interactions.
When he's throwing stuff in the trash can.
Which is another thing that this movie set the precedent for that happens from then now on in the MCU, you know, kind of thing, is projecting these big, huge schematics out. But they said that, you know, Obadiah's heads-up display is the one that the company came up with. It's red, it's militaristic, it's very blocky and choppy and everything else. But when you see Tony's heads-up display, everything is very Apple, they said. It's all rounded and menus are like triple degrees and they'll separate and move and come around. And it's not just all a big, huge, blocky targeting thing. And I said, that's very Apple.
Well, yeah. I have a segue key to that. You're mentioning Iron Man's head-up display. Did you know that the sound of the target lock-on, where that came from?
No.
It came from the laser cannon firing of Space Invaders video game.
That's great. That's great.
They lifted that sound bite and used it. I tried to listen for it, but I didn't really hear it. And what's ironic is I was on a cruise recently that had an arcade with – you could play all the old arcade games for free, and I played several games of Space Invaders and Galaga.
That's so awesome. Speaking of sound, I love the sound design in the scenes when he's trying to restart his suit all the time. Like in the ice scene when he's trying to restart it after he falls, and also when he's damaged and he's coming back in after his fight with Obadiah, and it's going you know, it's just his repulsors are just firing a little bit at a time, but that noise it's making of
it's like a car choking out.
And he's trying to come on, let's go.
I mean, because he barely avoids going splat into, you know, a street.
Yeah, but he could survive it. Look at him in the desert. I mean, it didn't hurt him at all.
The street's a little harder, but I don't know. Christine Everhart, which is the perfect name for that Vanity Fair piece, mentions to Tony that he is the Da Vinci of our time. What I did not know is that Leonardo da Vinci was a military engineer in addition to being an artist and inventor. And his weapons designs included a giant crossbow, multi-barreled cannons, and an armored vehicle powered by hand cranks.
I didn't know that at all.
I didn't either. So what's funny is, you know, Stark says, I'm not a painter, but you know what? Da Vinci did more than paint.
Well, he wasn't a big inventor. I knew he was an inventor. I just didn't know all the details. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he was maybe the inspiration for the word Renaissance man, if I'm not mistaken.
Of course.
Yeah.
And I know he did helicopters, submarine, all kinds of early inventions.
And then lastly, and I lifted this from IMDb, is Obadiah plays a piece on the piano. Do you know what that piece is?
No.
It is a piece from I don't have the name of it, actually. It is a piece by Salieri, though. And what was Salieri?
The runner-up to Mozart. He was just,
right. Yeah. He was the rival of Mozart, whereas Stark was the rival of Obadiah. And I can't help but think that either Favreau or Bridges did that intentionally.
Oh, yeah. That was definitely intentional.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's a very cool parallel to history.
That's very neat. I did not know. Mm-hmm. That's a good trivia. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so, too. Mm-hmm. I did. And that, I think, my friend, is all I have on this little film.
Well, it's not, in my opinion, not a little film, and it definitely should be on the 100 and 1001 movies. I mean, come on. It's excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent film.
I totally agree. Folks, we ran a little long out there, but we knew we would because we always do with our season finale films. They always tend to be long because we pick blockbusters. And this is no exception. I highly recommend this movie. I'm quite sure that my partner here, David Horton, would highly recommend this movie as well, especially if you're a Marvel fan. If you haven't seen it and you're a Marvel fan, I'm gobsmacked. I cannot imagine that you have not seen this movie. And for those of you out there listening to us, we would like to thank you for joining us on this, our 39th venture into season 5. If you need a little bit more, you can go back to past seasons, either audio-wise on your favorite podcast platform of choice, or you can watch us on YouTube from season 3 going forward, as well as some of our subsidiary short shows that we have on there. If you want to do deeper dives with us into some classic television series like Star Trek or The X-Files, please become a patron. And for less than the cost of a cup of coffee a month, you can get access to The X-Files Declassified or The Dilithium Chamber, which are shows dedicated to, I guess you would say, episode by episode analysis of the first 2 seasons so far of both shows. And until, well, you know what? There's more. If you want to get some cool Johnny merch, go to our website. I've got all kinds of Johnny merchandise there, including t-shirts, mugs, and those kind of things, which, you know, show your support for our show, please.
Yeah. Send us a pic of you wearing it. We'd love that.
Yeah, and also we would love to hear your suggestions for future shows. We have decided, as of pretty recently, that we're going to do listener request episodes, and we have 3 coming up next season.
Yep.
And we will be excited to announce those in the promo later on this summer. And until next time.
Next time, our last time.
Yeah. Our last time. We're going to the horror land.
Yeah, of course. We're going to end in the dark. Well, actually, we end in the sun, but it's a scary sun.
Yeah, most of the time we end on a sci-fi. This time we're ending on a horror. Yeah. That's going to be interesting. It will be epic.
Yes,
so join us.
Join us. See you next week.
Join us. All right. See you. Bye.